Namaste. So last time we shared some reflection upon the uncertainty which seems to haunt human life. In yoga, the mystics tried to find the base where alone certainty can be found. So behind this mutable, ever-changing world, which leads to uncertainty. Uncertainty is simply because the world is constantly changing and we have no say over the change. It's like we are watching a cinema and we have taken the ticket and we are sitting in the cinema and now the scenes are running. We can't say stop this, let this not happen. It's unfolding according to a logic which we don't understand. We can enjoy the cinema, we can weep, we can whatever way, we can even get up and come out of the cinema. The moksha is like that. But the cinema is unfolding and we have no control over it. And this can lead to a great degree of insecurity because of this uncertainty of the unfolding. But on the other hand, this can also propel people to search for the stable basis. Is there a stable basis behind this ever-moving universe? And we know the Isha Upanishad speaks about it. It says, Isha Vasyam Idam Sarvam Yat Kinch Jagatyam Jagat. Behind all this individual motion, within the universal motion, this perpetual motion, there is a stable basis. And that stable basis is the Lord. Now, whether we try to find that stable basis through the way of works, through the way of jnana, or much more easily through the way of simply cling to the Lord or let Him hold and carry us. Once we touch that solid bedrock, there is security. Because even if everything were to be destroyed, even if the whole creation were to go away, that will remain. And we also remain, the soul is also indestructible. So whatever is immutable, by its nature remains. So this is one approach. Humanity has, however, one thing is very sure, if we really look at the world, and humanity does recognize it, most of the people who are little more sensitive recognize that this is not a perfect and ideal world. Now, when they look at change, they often declare that all change is bad because they are constantly seeing the change and it's overwhelming. So, we know that this is not an ideal world. Unfortunately, we base it based on our ego comforts that, you know, the fact is this world is not perfect, but we base it based on how my individual life is unfolding, which is a very narrow egocentric way of looking at it, that as if everything, if it happens in my life good, then world is good. Now, many people, you know, realize misery of life when it touches them, but they don't realize the misery of countless people as it is going through. So when we look at life in general, though there are very beautiful, happy moments, there are more happy moments, but yet it is not a perfect world. There is in it wickedness, there is perversity, there is not just death and destruction, but there is a depravity of taste, there is crudeness, there is vulgarity, there is wickedness, all these things are there. These creatures which are poisonous, who in one moment can destroy man's neat world. And added to all that is human consciousness, which has made things much worse than what nature in its pristine purity or its animal and sub-animal states had done. With human beings, things have become even more worse. So, given this, we understand it's not a perfect world. Yet within man, there is an urge to make this world perfect. He's born with it. So, very often, there are two lines that we take towards when we encounter the imperfection of the world. Of course, again, I am not speaking of those who for egoistic reason feel this is imperfect. Just because in their personal life they met with a tragedy. We should be like Buddha, vast in consciousness. His own life is very nice. Or someone like Sri Aurobindo. Everything is picture perfect. I mean, he could have been the topmost leader. He was the topmost leader in the freedom struggle. The mother, she had no reason why she should suddenly leave everything aside for working for a new world. And there are many other people like that who have, on a much lesser scale, their life was very fine, but they have seen that this world is imperfect. So one method is to make it perfect by secular means. By that is meant is that, well, there is sickness, so let's find the cure. So let's multiply hospitals, let's, multiply doctors, let's have a better medical training, etc., etc. Then there are others who, again, with secular means, that there is unequal distribution of wealth, so let's try to, you know, find various systems of governance so that wealth can be equally distributed, which has its own problems, as we know, because sometimes it can breed laziness. On another side, it's good if everybody is ready and prepared for it. So there are different systems of governance which we try to evolve so that human life can be made perfect, maybe a more rational order, as you know, we see in the 17th, 18th, 19th century, this thought came. Even now, to an extent, the rationalistic age of enlightenment, unfortunately it's called enlightenment, but it's a rationalistic order where by reason we can make life perfect. Now, mankind tries those means, giving, for instance, money to the poor, giving clothes to the poor, to the deprived, to the needy. All that is fine. I mean, this is an effort, but this is not going to really help us come out of the predicament. All this has been tried several times, and as the mother recounts a story of, you know, Saint Francis, where he used to treat the sick and provide things to the poor, and somebody remarked that, you know, it seems that the poor are multiplying because the doles are being given. So when we give freebies, then the poor multiply, because now people realize that without any effort I can get something. So they multiply because people go into a mode of inertia. So this is, and nevertheless, this is one kind of remedy that people try to apply. At least the bhava is good. The method is, of course, very, very inadequate. It doesn't solve the human problem because it doesn't even know what the human problem is. The second method is that life will be what it is, and we have the way of the Buddha that come out of it. As long as you are in it, it will be imperfect. So there is no way it can be made perfect. The only way is to come out of it. Now, in certain variations, all the mokshwadi dharas, and there are multiple, this sect, that sect, this religion, that religion, ultimately towards an otherworldly salvation, is actually pointing toward that. That the world is imperfect. It's imperfect because, unfortunately, it was created by God, but man made it imperfect. This is not a very solid argument, because who created man? Well, nature evolved man. Did nature equip man with all the know-how and the will to really come out of this state? No, it is an evolutionary process. So when man is evolving from the animal towards the full manhood, he's bound to make many mistakes, like a baby growing up into adulthood. But there is a tendency to look at the neat world, so people pass on the buck to man, that it is he who is responsible. As far as God is concerned, he only comes to set things right. But this is not the true Vedanta. In true Vedanta, the whole responsibility is with the source. That's what Sri Krishna's vision, even on the battlefield of Kurukshetra, sees, that the whole responsibility is his. Human beings can help in the process, they can hinder the process. There is a certain degree of say, but not the entire responsibility. So when we talk about quitting, we are simply saying that this world has nothing to do with God. But there is another line of thought in Indian thought, that no, it is God who has made, not only made this world, he is immanent in this world. He is present in every zarra zarra, as they say, every dust of atom, every atom of dust, every grain of dust. If this be so, then the logical conclusion is that there would be a silent pressure in creation to manifest what is hidden inside it. Just like a baby, you know, as it grows up, it begins to unfold what had gone in, either the conception of parents, which may have been beautiful or may have been ambitious, may have been their defects, at the same time physically, the physical structure. Now the child is unfolding the seed that has gone in. The tree is unfolding the seed that has gone in, because seed contains the whole tree. So too, if the seed of creation is divine, creation is going to unfold the divinity inherent in it. So there is a third solution, not either of escape nor of this imperfect means of manipulating human beings as they are by outer means. But for that we must understand the real malady. And Sri Aurobindo says very, very beautifully, it's something so obvious, but it doesn't somehow has not, you know, it has not, nobody has suddenly had this wonderful insight, intuition, that we are limited by what? We are limited by our consciousness. So if a consciousness is of an animal, we can only enjoy that much which an animal enjoys. Tell a human being whose consciousness is close to the animal, he will enjoy only food, good sleep, etc. He will not enjoy a fine poetry or a beautiful music. He'll go off to sleep. Tell a human being to enjoy something which is divine, and he will again go off to sleep. Because, you know, it's a question of the level of consciousness at which we stand. So depending upon our consciousness, we look at life, understand it, and can act upon life. Now, once we understand it, then half the problem is over. So instead of changing systems of government, environment, all these are necessary, but they are temporary halfway measures. The real thing we must insist upon is a change of consciousness. And that's the solution that Sri Aurobindo gives. He says all problems are because of the state of consciousness in which we live. That's what the mother also gives. She gave him one of the very powerful messages. The future of earth and man depends upon a change of consciousness, and the change is bound to come. But it is left to men to decide whether they will collaborate with the change or the change is thrust upon them by the power of crashing circumstances. So what is this change? The change is that out of mental being we must grow into spiritual beings. What does it mean? Again, we should not fall back into the pattern of what we understand by spirituality, meditation and moksha. That is not the change that she is speaking about, because that is one kind of solution that has been existing for centuries. And perhaps because of this way of looking at life, that life is forever condemned to imperfection, the spiritual impulsion never had force to change it. It had the force in the opposite direction. So it did liberate few people, but life continued to remain as it is. But there have been instances of men like, yogis like King Janak, Ashupati of yore, Shri Krishna himself, Lord Rama. They came to show that in this world, while being in the world, the spiritual consciousness doesn't reject the world, but at least accepts it. Even if they could not change it, they at least knew that there is an unfolding, as when Shri Krishna says, Lok Sangraharth, to I am working so that the forward march of mankind can continue. So there is a forward march, there is a journey. Mankind is moving from the mentalized human consciousness under the control of the dominance of the ego and driven by desires, to a more intuitive spiritual consciousness where human beings will no more be motivated by selfish personal gains, but by something else. In fact, to act for anything which is personal will become impossible for them. They'll feel as if paralyzed, because they won't feel the inner energy, the enthusiasm, the motivation to do it. So this is the kind of state towards which humanity will progress, where instead of any outer compulsion, whether of social or religious or legal compulsions, from within, the intuition will tell us what is the beautiful, harmonious and divine way to live. So this is the change, the law of truth unfolding in our own life. So this is the direction of the change. And that is what is meant by spiritual evolution of mankind, not yet another sect in which we are taught a method of meditation or a technique to raise our kundalini and eventually merge with the infinite. That's all old stuff. It has served its purpose in two ways. One, it kept alive the spiritual impulsion, which is very good. Perhaps more than this could not be done. Second, it also gave glimpses of some section of humanity, an odd Sri Ramakrishna here, an odd Buddha there, that there are possibilities within us which we don't know. So it also opened the doors. I mean, they are spiritual geniuses of mankind. But in them we glimpse the higher possibility, that there is a higher possibility. So even before the moksha, there are things which manifest in their life, that there are possibilities in mankind which we don't know, a way of knowing, a way of having a power over circumstances. Like Sri Raman Maharshi, we know that, it is said that within his ashram, nearby in his ashram, he's on the mountain, even the wild beasts, they tend to become very calm and quiet. We see this in the ashram also, that how the dogs, they respond so beautifully, and many wild creatures, whatever comes, they tend to be much more milder than what otherwise is. Even human beings, if they had gone in the world, what harm and damage they would have done. But here, as if, they are like toothless tigers. So this is what happens as a result of the pressure of the spiritual consciousness. And if more and more people will develop a spiritual consciousness, which she says is a reversal of consciousness, it's a different way of seeing altogether. Normal man sees and weighs things, values them only based on how does it personally benefit him. or doesn't benefit. But a spiritual consciousness sees things from a larger holistic point of view. But not only in terms of a brief space, but also in terms of the long progression of time. So it has this simultaneous vision, one of the larger sense of space at a cosmic level, and also in terms of time, the larger spaces of time. Spontaneously, automatically, this kind of a cosmic consciousness, a cosmic sentiment, a cosmic feeling is emerging in humanity, and this is what is meant by spiritual evolution, where a new consciousness, not the laboring analytical human mind, rational human mind, perhaps this may in fact become less and less, but a more intuitive, holistic way of looking at life, at this world, and a more holistic and intuitive way of not only understanding and experiencing, but dealing with life and all its manifold situations and activities, that is going to emerge. And this is the next phase, and this is the answer and the solution that Mother and Sri Aurobindo give to us. No more multiplication of the outer methods. People often ask, what is there? Are there free hospitals in Sri Aurobindo ashram, or do the devotees engage in free distribution of food or blankets? No, this has been done for ad nauseam, ad infinitum, and there are people who do it. But here, it's where light is distributed free. Here, the divine love is distributed free. All that is required is opening and receptivity. Nobody charges anything for that, and that is what is being given. A truth which is too great for human intellect, that is being given free. And all of that is available now in Mother and Sri Aurobindo's books. All that is needed is that all this has been given free to us, but just as free ration may be left to rot, so too we have inherited this wonderful new possibility in human consciousness of evolving into the superhumanity of tomorrow. Not superhumanity in an aggrandized, egoistic, titanic way, but a humble superhumanity full of compassion, full of light, full of truth, moved by the divine love, moved by divine sweetness and divine joy and peace. This is the possibility that they have given to us and they offer to us. It is up to us to take it or fall back into the usual routine or find another sect which can liberate us from the problems of this world into the heaven of moksha. This is the choice we have to make. Thank you.